Erica Castro-Miles and her boyfriend, Stephen Wiggins, were staying at a hotel in Kingston Springs, Tennessee. The couple argued. Stephen kicked Erica out of the room, leaving her naked and distressed. He then left the hotel with Erica's 1998 gray Saturn. Erica, meanwhile, went to get help from the hotel clerk, Lear Bonsignor.
I had a young woman come to the office, and she didn't have any clothes on, and she was upset, crying.
Did she require police assistance?
Well, I thought she did.
Did you make a 911 call?
I did.
The director of the 911 dispatch, Linda Nichols, took the call.
What was the nature of this call?
So this one was labeled as a request an officer.
And what was requested based on this report?
They wanted an officer to come out due to, it looks like maybe a domestic type situation.
A be on the lookout, or BOLO, was placed on the car. There are no reports of the car being seen for the rest of the day or night. But at some point, Stephen Wiggins returned and picked up Erica. By the next morning, May 30th, the couple had made it to the intersection of Tidwell Switch Road and Sam Vineyard Road in Dixon County, Tennessee. The car was still on Sam Vineyard, partially turned onto Tidwell Switch. The front nose of the car was on the shoulder, but the rest of the vehicle was still in the lane. The back passenger tire was flat. Angela Ezel thought the car was in a dangerous spot.
When I approached the intersection of Sam Vineyard and Tittle Switch, there was a car parked on the wrong side of the road facing the wrong direction.
Did you notice anything in particular about the car?
I noticed that the back windows were fogged up, like it had been sitting there for a while. And there were two occupants in the car, a male in the driver's seat and a female in the passenger seat.
She thought the occupants were either passed out or asleep. She called 911 to report the car on her way to work. It was 6:19 a.m. Shortly before the suspicious vehicle call came in, Sheriff Deputy Sergeant Daniel Baker was leaving his house for his shift. He said goodbye to his 22-month-old daughter and wife, Lisa.
Can you tell the jury what happened that day?
That morning, he left when I was making my coffee, and he would always sneak a drink because he never wanted to drink coffee, but he liked to aggravate me. So I remember him doing that, and I remember him telling, going in Meredith's room and telling her bye, because he was in there for a minute, so I assume that's what he was doing. And then he left, and I finished getting ready for work, and I went to work.
On his way into the sheriff's office, even before roll call, Sergeant Baker heard the suspicious vehicle call. Since it was close to his home, he responded. He approached the vehicle like a routine traffic stop. He asked the driver, Stephen Wiggins, for his identification, noting there was a passenger inside the car. Within moments, Sergeant Baker radioed in, "Shots fired, officer down." This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 174. On the morning of May 30th, 2018, Corporal Christopher Lashley was patrolling the area about 15 miles away when he heard a call come over the radio about a suspicious vehicle. He started heading over towards the scene when dispatch alerted that the suspicious vehicle was actually stolen. He then heard something else.
Heard an altercation over the radio, and I heard something. I heard gunshots over the radio.
You heard gunshots over the radio?
Yes, sir.
And, and Corporal, I know this is tough. I'm trying to walk through it, just kind of step by step. So let me back up just a little bit. You heard dispatch say that a vehicle was stolen?
Yes, sir.
If you were on scene and you ran a license plate number, is that what you would do to confirm whether a vehicle had been reported stolen?
Yes, sir.
Like how would you do it? Would you key up on your radio?
Yes, sir.
And what would you ask dispatch?
I would first run the tag and then dispatch would come back to me and inform me that it's been, you know, reported stolen.
But that tag number?
Yes, okay. And where it was stolen from. Okay.
And you say on the morning of May 30th, you heard dispatch over the radio confirm that it was stolen?
Yes, sir.
Now, at some point after that, I believe you've testified you heard what you thought was an altercation?
Yes, sir.
And also some gunfire?
Yes, sir.
What did you do then?
I sped up as fast as I could try.
We've heard some brief testimony about priority one and priority two. Were you priority one after you heard the gunshots?
Yes, sir.
And does that mean lights and sirens?
Yes, sir.
On his way to the intersection, Corporal Lashley saw Sergeant Baker's car, Car 500, pass him. He got on the radio and asked Sergeant Baker if he was good. A voice responded from Sergeant Baker's radio. 10-4, one in custody.
Did you recognize the voice that said one in custody?
I haven't worked with Daniel Hartley on his shift. I didn't know if he was worked up or...
Sure.
I couldn't recognize this voice.
Corporal Lashley wasn't the only deputy who went out to the scene. Sergeant Keith Dearborn remembered the 10-4 coming through the radio. To him, it didn't sound like Sergeant Baker.
On the radio, I heard one in custody. But what was strange was it didn't sound like Daniel. I couldn't tell you who it was, but I knew it wasn't him. And I've heard Daniel's voice many times, and, you know, working with him, working for him. And it confused me. I didn't know what was going on. You know, it's like, I heard that, but it just didn't, I couldn't process it. And I was talking to Deputy Richley on the phone. I said, was it just me or does that not sound like him? Because we were still on our way down there. I was on the phone with him. I said, something, what was it? Is it my radio? Is it me? Am I just not? It's not one now. At least I didn't sound like him.
Now, Sergeant Dearborn, I'm going to ask you about the when you hear the 10-4-1 in custody. What does that mean to you as an officer?
Well, it means it means that they've taken custody of a suspect or a prisoner. That particular situation. If you hear somebody struggling and you hear 10-4-1 in custody, you're like, okay, well, they got them. This ain't secure. So, and that's why me and him back, we're the furthest ones out, so we backed down because we thought everything was okay. We thought everything was fine.
And the language that was being used, was that language that you are used to as a law enforcement officer that you do in your everyday job?
Yeah. And it was confusing because the language was there, but it didn't sound like him.
Deputy Steve Richley thought the same.
What did you think when you heard this transmission on the radio? The one in custody and en route to central dispatch.
It was off.
Fair enough.
It wasn't normal.
Wasn't normal. Did you keep heading south?
Yes, sir.
And did you arrive at the Tidwell Switch Sam Binyard intersection?
Yes, sir.
And what did you do when you arrived there?
I was the third car. And, got out, walked to the corner, and just kind of walking through the scene. Just what's all going on. Met up with Lashley and kind of we started walking around.
The car was abandoned. What was present was a pool of blood, broken sunglasses, Sergeant Baker's key card, and a button from his uniform.
When you saw those, what was your first thought?
I didn't know. Excuse me. I didn't know. You know, it wasn't good. I knew that. And the blood, you know, it's... I'd been a cop for a long time. And when I seen the color of that blood, I knew it was bad.
Neither Sergeant Baker nor the suspect he was supposed to have in custody were anywhere to be found. Corporal Lashley took a picture of the blood and texted it to Sergeant Baker. He asked if it was the suspect's blood. He never got a response. The scene was blocked off. The Dixon County Sheriff's Office waited for the Tennessee Bureau of Investigations, or TBI, to arrive and process it. But Deputy Richley wanted to focus on finding Sergeant Baker. He had been his training officer. He got the GPS coordinates for Car 500. It was on Bear Creek Valley Road. He didn't understand why Sergeant Baker would have gone that way, but he headed over there.
And when you got on Bear Creek Valley Road, is that inside Dixon County?
Yes, sir.
What did you observe?
Have you ever driven down chert roads, like the dirty brown roads? You know, when somebody's driven in front of you, it turns up and it's darker. And I saw one set of tracks. It would go from broken asphalt, chert, broken asphalt, chert. And so I knew there was a car down there within just not long because it was still dark color where the tracks were. And I followed the tracks till, and there was a sharp left turn. You can see where it turned over a little more. And there was barbed wire strands just kind of hanging. And the grass was high in a field, and I saw tracks going through the grass.
He drove into the field following the tracks. He parked his patrol car and got out. He walked the tree line for a bit before finally coming across Car 500. The windows were up and the doors were locked. He yelled for Sergeant Baker. There was no answer. Then he saw a shoe print that looked like someone had hopped over the fence. He decided to follow the trail. By this time, Deputy Brian Cave had arrived.
So we hopped the fence. We both went across the field to the creek. I went left through the creek. We were just yelling for him.
While they were searching for Sergeant Baker, agents from the Drug Task Force, Agent Nathaniel Proctor and Darren Scott Adams, were dispatched to the scene. Agents Proctor and Adams came across Car 500. No one was there, but there was blood on the rear driver's side quarter panel.
I saw a streak of blood down the rear quarter panel on the driver's side, and not being able to clear the vehicle, I radioed to, at the time, Lieutenant McCliss, I believe, and got permission to bust the window out of the car.
Okay. Why did you feel it was necessary to bust the window out of the car?
Because I couldn't clear the vehicle. Obviously, nobody knew where Sergeant Baker was. Saw the blood on the vehicle, wanted to clear the vehicle.
Okay. And did you receive permission to knock the window out?
I did.
And what happened then?
I took my expandable baton and I knocked the driver's side window out of the car.
Okay. And what did you do after that?
Smoke hit me in the face. Hit the unlock button. Fumbled it for a minute, tried to unlock the door. Looked in on the passenger side. I could see his patrol bag sitting in the passenger seat, and then he'd been set on fire. The fire was out at that time, so obviously I cleared the front of the vehicle, and I moved to the back door on the driver's side and opened the door, and his legs and feet come out into my chest, and
What was your reaction when you opened that rear door?
As a father, I thought about his little girl.
Sergeant Baker's body was in the back seat. He had been shot, and it was clear to the agents that someone had tried to burn him. Agent Adams' first thought was to try and save him, but it was obvious it was too late.
It was just a lot of trauma, a lot of blood. I went back around just because of the positioning of the body, went back in through the passenger side. The way he was slumped in, I went to pull back on his shoulder to check for a pulse. And that's when I was able to see his head. And I knew then that there was absolutely nothing else that was going to be able to be done. So at that point, I tried to back up, take a breath, and realize that this crime scene might be the only thing that would lead us to his killer.
Agent Adams noticed Sergeant Baker's body cam in the back seat. It was hot to the touch. But he knew if they could get images from the body cam, they would know who killed Sergeant Baker. He put it in his pocket. Additional officers arrived and started processing the scene. A perimeter was set up and canines were brought in. But the killer appeared to have gotten away. The manhunt for Sergeant Baker's killer was vast, with about 40 agencies involved. The body cam footage did show them their suspect. Through it, they were able to identify Stephen Wiggins. Now they just had to find him. Members of the Tennessee Highway Patrol searched along Stinson Road. It was day 3 of their search. They had been given pictures of who they were looking for, and one by one they cruised down the street. Highway Patrolman Chris Judd was the lead car. He was scanning the area when he noticed that the patrol car behind him was no longer in his rear view. He put his car in reverse to see what was going on. He saw another trooper with a male kneeling on the ground next to him at gunpoint. It looked like they had who they were searching for.
At any point, were you able to make a positive identification of that individual?
Yes, sir.
And how did you make that identification?
I asked the individual for his name, and he stated Stephen Wiggins. I also, as part of our briefing, we were given pictures of the individual and known body marks, such as the tattoo on the right arm. I believe it was of a pit bull and a Confederate flag on his right arm. So I pulled up his right sleeve, and I did observe that same tattoo that was seen in the pictures they showed us.
Stephen Wiggins was wet. His clothes were disheveled and dirty. They handcuffed him and took him into custody without incident.
No resistance whatsoever, correct?
No, sir. Not from my point of view. From the time that I started interacting, that I laid eyes on them, there was no, he was cooperative.
And even when you asked him his name, he gave you the name Stephen Wiggins. Is that correct?
With Stephen was a backpack. It was processed by TBI agents at the hospital after Stephen was taken there for treatment. Multiple guns were found inside. Stephen was treated for mild hypothermia. He told investigators he had hidden in a creek for 3 days while the manhunt took place. After he was discharged from the hospital, he was back in custody. Investigators interviewed him and asked about what happened at Tidwell Switch. "I'm sorry," Stephen began, his head on the table. Some of this audio is difficult to hear, but I'll recap after each clip.
"You're sorry?"
"Stephen, we'll have to ask you to speak up, my friend.
I'm sorry.
Well, we understand that. That's what we're trying to kind of get an understanding of what happened, what transpired, what sequence of events. Okay? We're not, like Nathan said, you're a man.
He started screaming at me for no reason.
Okay?
And he was to draw his gun, and I didn't even have money in my hand or nothing. I don't know why he started screaming at me. I was the brother, he just started.
Well, what happened?
He hadn't even run my name or nothing. Okay. He just started screaming at me. I don't know why. I was trying to get out the door. The door was messed up. He never asked me to step out. And I was trying to get out of it. And it was messed up. And he started screaming and stuff up his lungs at me. He just started screaming at me."
Stephen said Sergeant Baker was screaming at him, and he was scared for his life and the life of his girlfriend. He thought Sergeant Baker was going to kill them. He said he had a hard time getting out of the car, that the driver's side door wouldn't open. When Sergeant Baker came around to the passenger side, he shot him. He was asked what he did after he pulled the trigger. He said he tried doing chest compressions on him and then checked his pulse. He then decided to shoot Sergeant Baker again because, quote, "like a dog, you know, man, it's suffering, you make sure." He then placed his body in the patrol car, saying it was heavy. They asked him what he did next. He said he drove, but he wasn't sure where to. He didn't know where he was. The investigators asked him about using the police radio, if he had been pretending to be Sergeant Baker. Stephen admitted he had. Once he got to the field, Stephen said he removed the GPS tracker from the car. He took Sergeant Baker's service weapon and his backup weapon. He said he then began to think about the forensics. He even mentioned the TV show CSI.
Okay, and what do you know, what made you think about forensics? Just killed a cop, so forensics made you think about what? Proof.
He said he knew he had to get rid of the evidence, so he made the decision to set two fires, one in the back seat and one in the front. After he did that, he said he got out and grabbed his backpack. Then he ran into the field. Stephen Wiggins was facing 10 charges in Sergeant Daniel Baker's death, including first-degree premeditated murder, first-degree felony murder, vehicular arson, impersonating a law enforcement officer, and abuse of a corpse. If convicted, he could be sentenced to death. His girlfriend, Erica Castro Miles, was also charged with first-degree murder. She had been inside the vehicle when Sergeant Baker was shot. According to the indictment, Sergeant Baker's body camera showed what had happened. Stephen Wiggins could be seen firing at least five shots, one of which hit Sergeant Baker as he tried to take cover. Then, while he was lying on the ground, Stephen shot him five more times. According to the autopsy, Sergeant Baker was shot six times, twice to his torso, once to his hand, and three to the left side of his head. Stephen's trial started in August 2021. During their opening statements, the prosecution gave the jury the sequence of events based on Sergeant Baker's body cam footage. It didn't match Stephen Wiggins' story.
You will then see that Sergeant Baker said, "Okay, I'm going to walk around to the other side." As he was walking around the rear of the vehicle, going towards the passenger side, the defendant removed a .45 caliber High Point semi-automatic pistol. As Sergeant Baker approached the passenger side window, which had been rolled down, the defendant leveled off and shot through the passenger side window. Sergeant Baker ran backwards from the car and issued his final words, a warning. Shots fired, officer down. Sergeant Baker collapsed on the ground, still alive. The defendant exits the vehicle out of the driver's side window, which he had previously said was broken. He approaches Sergeant Baker and at close range executes him. This is on video.
Prosecutor Ray Crouch said that Stephen then moved Sergeant Baker's car. Then he loaded the body inside.
Now the passenger, Eric Castro Miles, runs away from the scene. She is not a part of this trial. This trial is State versus Wiggins. He loads Sergeant Baker's body in. He begins driving away from the scene, at which point the defendant, pretending to be law enforcement, answers multiple radio calls from Dixon County Central Dispatch. He's thinking clearly and quickly, and he responds, 10-4, one in custody, en route, Dixon County Central.
Crouch also stressed that Stephen took Sergeant Baker's guns before setting him on fire. He then closed the doors, locked the doors, and fled. Stephen's guilt during the trial, as prosecutors presented their evidence and witnesses, was never in question. The defense admitted as much right away.
There's no question that on May 30th, 2018, Stephen Wiggins killed Sergeant Daniel Baker. And he did so without excuse and without justification.
But they argued that it was not premeditated murder.
The only question that you as a jury may have to determine when you deliberate after hearing all the proof is whether or not it was premeditated. Whether or not in that moment, Stephen Wiggins used reflection and judgment. The proof in this case is going to make you angry. It's going to make you angry at Stephen. And I know that because it made me angry. And it wasn't until I was able to learn more about Stephen, his life history and his life course, that I was even able to begin to fathom how something like this could happen.
After 3 days of testimony from the state of Tennessee, the jury was released to deliberate on August 5th, 2021. It took them just over an hour to decide that Stephen was guilty of all charges. But as the defense had said in their opening statements, Stephen's guilt was never really in question. It was the next part of the trial, Stephen's sentencing, that the defense team wanted to focus on in order to save Stephen's life. They argued that Stephen's actions were due to mitigating circumstances and that he did not deserve the death penalty. But the sentencing hearing started with Lisa Baker, Sergeant Baker's wife. She told the jury that she was lost without him. She added that she couldn't measure the true impact of losing him.
There are so many ways that this life is unfair. Daniel was the very best of the best and so much more than I ever thought I deserved. He was honorable, true, and I love with all your heart kind of guy. He helped many strangers and never expected anything in return. He tried to promote good and always lead by example. I have begged many times for God to let me trade places with him. Not because I wish to die, but because Daniel deserves to live.
She ended by making a promise to Stephen Wiggins.
I'm prepared to spend the rest of my life making sure yours, Stephen Wiggins, is miserable. However long that may take, you better believe I'm strong enough and I'm not going anywhere.
Defense attorney David Hopkins told the jury that sentencing was an exercise in using their moral compass. He said that during this portion, they're to judge not just a crime, but a life.
If it were only about the crime, then his life story and these mitigating circumstances that you've heard so much about in jury selection and that you all told the court that you would give meaningful consideration to would be meaningless. It wouldn't be necessary. But it is necessary and it's required. And you all repeatedly assured us in the court that at this phase of the trial, you could do just that. Some of you might give the weight of life to certain mitigating circumstances you're going to hear. For example, things like the terror and sexual assaults and physical abuse inflicted by Stephen's father on him and others, whether that warped his development and his moral compass. You may decide that that's a reason to punish him for something less than the death penalty. That is, give it the weight of life. Or the fact that Stephen has helped others in his life. How you will hear in this case that he actually saved the life of a coworker. That may be relevant to you, but it might not be relevant to another juror. And you could give that the weight of life. But you have to remember, this isn't a counting exercise. This isn't you just count up all of these mitigating circumstances. There's no magic number you have to reach. A single mitigating factor, a single piece of mitigating evidence could be the reason that you and your individual moral judgment decides to give that circumstance the weight of life.
He laid out some of the mitigating circumstances for the jury. The first being brain damage that Stephen had suffered as a child that went undiagnosed.
Stephen Wiggins' mother was severely beaten by his father while she was pregnant with Stephen. Stephen started getting beaten by his father before he ever came out of the womb. And he was born with a damaged brain. He has a hole in his brain. He has dead brain matter. And you're going to see and hear evidence of that during this trial. You will see the PET scans, the MRIs, and you're going to hear from experts who are going to talk about this. And I will remind you over and over again, we're not talking about excuses for behavior. We're talking about reasons, circumstances of his life. So you take someone who's getting beaten before he's born with organic brain damage, and that's how he starts out life. Not surprisingly, he had seizures, continues to have seizures throughout his entire life, which evidences the damaged brain. Doesn't excuse his behavior for what he did in this case. We're past the excuses. This is not a justification. But it will help you determine what the appropriate punishment is here.
Neurologist Dr. Aaron Bigler told the jury about the deficits in Stephen's brain. He talked about gray areas he saw that were filled with fluid.
So when we look at Mr. Wiggins' brain here face on, we see in the left hemisphere a normal appearing left hemisphere. The darker area here, this is the gray matter of the brain. This is where cell bodies are, and the white matter is a lighter gray, and that's where the brain connects. That's where axons are located. And so where you see this arrow pointing here, there's a dark area. So you don't see it in the left frontal, you see it in the right frontal. And that's some type of a defect in the brain. There's an abnormality that's here. This part of the anterior aspect of the frontal lobe, and I'm going to hold up a brain model. So this is a brain model here. It's casted from an actual healthy adult. But if I hold this like so, you can see that the frontal part of the brain indents down. It indents down. Like you're seeing in the screen here. And that is also what you're seeing right here. So these areas are important for a number of reasons, especially in regard to emotional control and regulation.
Dr. Bigler said each side of the brain should mirror the other. And in Stephen's case, they do not. The hole in his brain is filled with cerebral spinal fluid, he said. The next mitigating factor, according to the defense, was the actual abuse Stephen experienced from birth until he was 14 years old at the hands of his father. Stephen's brother testified to this, but he requested not to be broadcast, and so I'm leaving his testimony out of this podcast as well.
A lot of people talk about, well, I had a tough childhood. You're not going to hear about a tough childhood. You're going to hear about a childhood where it was daily, physical, psychological abuse. Beatings for no reason. When Stephen and his brother couldn't fall asleep at night, his father's solution to that was to beat them until they went to sleep or just quit fighting. He would beat them with anything he could reach, fishing poles, his fists, his belt. Daily. Stephen Wiggins saw his mother beaten when she would try to intervene. And this went on every day until he was about 14 years old, when Stephen's father chased him and his mother through the woods, shooting at them with a rifle, trying to kill them. And when they did finally get away, Stephen's father doused their mobile home with gasoline in an attempt to kill them. The environment Stephen grew up in was one where his father isolated the family like many abusers do. He didn't let them have friends. He didn't let them go places. He kept the door locked with multiple deadbolts and all of the windows covers because in his paranoia, he told the family, well, the police are going to come kill you at any minute. Ridiculous things like that were said to children, not once or twice, but every day for well over a decade.
Juanita, Stephen's mother, took the stand and corroborated her son's claims about his dad chasing them through the woods. Other mitigating factors included Stephen's dysfunctional family and current positive relationships with his family. Stephen's 10-year-old son wrote a letter to his father, part of which was read aloud in court. That part read, quote, "I don't know much about my father, but I know for a fact that he loves me. When I think of my father, I remember his big hugs in the morning the most. I remember feeling the warmth and tightness of them. They made me feel safe." Stephen's attorney, Luke Evans, pleaded for mercy from the jury, saying, "Stephen Wiggins will walk into a Tennessee Department of Corrections facility and leave in a casket." When the prosecutor, Ray Crouch, spoke to the jury, he told them what their aggravating factors were, including the fact that Stephen had previously been convicted of a crime, that the murder was especially heinous and cruel, that the murder was committed to avoid an arrest, that the murder was committed against a law officer during his official duties, and that Stephen knowingly mutilated the body. During the state's presentation to the jury, they presented a witness who argued that Stephen's poor brain function was actually due in part to his methamphetamine addiction. They also pointed to a tattoo Stephen had gotten in prison, which read, "Ain't got no time for that death row." The body cam footage was then played again, and Prosecutor Crouch said, "The only person in this case who never had a chance was Sergeant Baker." The jury, according to state law, had to be unanimous in order to sentence Stephen to death. They deliberated for about an hour and 40 minutes before deciding that he should be put to death. Stephen was placed into Sergeant Baker's handcuffs and led out of the courtroom. He was transported to prison in a car that was marked with the number 500. Erica Castro Miles, Stephen's girlfriend, is currently waiting for a trial date for her charge of first-degree murder in the case. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts about this case. Do you agree with the sentence? How would you have voted if you were a juror, especially in that sentencing portion? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Polly Katowski with Law and Crime. You can follow her on Twitter and Instagram at Polly Katowski. If you'd like to hear these episodes without the ads and hear additional Court Junkie bonus episodes, check out my Patreon options at courtjunkie.com/support. And be sure to subscribe to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/courtjunkie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.